I would like to invite Mary Brown from OSU Press to come up and introduce today's speaker.
The Random Reviews Committee and Christina Eisenberg would like to thank you all very much for coming today. As I think some of you know, if not all of you, today would have been all the Leopold's 125th birthday. So we were very glad that it worked out like this. I was pleased to be able to introduce Christina and have this review done because I'm a native of Wisconsin. I lived there for 47 years. And it's a gift to have grown up there. Oregon is wonderful. But when you grow up in Wisconsin, you learn about Aldo Leopold early on, and you come to have a great deal of respect for him. Also, I used to work at the University of Wisconsin Press before I worked at OSU Press, and was fortunate enough to work on a number of Leopold books there, some of which I believe are on the cart in the back. Our library colleagues have put together a number of the Leopold books for you. Christina Eisenberg, our reviewer today, is a conservation biologist. She's a Boone and Crockett Fellow, and she's a PhD candidate in forestry and wildlife at OSU. And she informed me she's almost through with her dissertation and will soon be taking another big step in her career. Her book, this book, The Wolf's Tooth, Trophic Cascades and Biodiversity, was published by Island Press in April 2010 and has already been reprinted several times. And it's a wonderful way of seeing how Leopold's insight, scientific rigor, and great humanity and compassion live on in scholars like Deborah. Deborah's research, she also asked me to mention that she is the nonfiction editor and guest managing editor for Whitefish Review. I encourage you to look that up yourselves. Christina's scientific research focuses on wolves, elk, and aspen in the Rocky Mountains, particularly in the far northern Rocky Mountains and over into Canada. She is the research director on the High Lonesome Ranch in Colorado, which is in the process of being recolonized by wolves. And Aldo Leopold scholar, she's actively engaged in ecological restoration that supports ecosystem-scale wolf conservation on private and public lands. Christina has a master's degree in environmental studies from Prescott College in Arizona. When she is not at Oregon State University, she lives in a log cabin with her family in a very remote part of northwestern Montana. What Christina did not include in her biography, because she's probably too modest, but I will tell you, is that just like Aldo Leopold, Christina Eisenberg is a really gifted communicator. She's a wonderful writer. She's also an outstanding scientist. She's equally at ease speaking with academics, her peers in the scientific community, and the general public. A quick review of her CV would show you that she has spoken and written to a really wide variety of audiences. In fact, some of you may have seen a lot of detailed information about her research in a March 2010 article in the National Geographic magazine, which was entitled The Wolf Wars. Oh, and just one other plug for a Wisconsin Leopold thing. For more information about Leopold, his legacy, and current efforts, and if you want to go visit the famous shack near Baraboo, Wisconsin, I encourage all of you to go to the website for the Aldo Leopold Foundation. It's a wonderful resource. Christina.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for coming. I'm going to ask you to please let me know if you can hear me all right or if you can't, so I can adjust the microphone. So I'm going to be showing a lot of images from Aldo Leopold's life and work. And these come courtesy of the Aldo Leopold Foundation. And some holographic images of his writings and journals, and that comes from the University of Wisconsin archives. Some of this material was part of my master's thesis research, and some of it appears synthesized in the book that I wrote. I started out at Oregon State University, drawn there by the Leopold Project, which was started by ecologist Bill Ripple to investigate the ecological concepts that Aldo Leopold came up with during a lifetime spent afield, and to take these ecological concepts and apply today's science to looking at what they can do to inform us about real-world conservation issues. I strongly urge you to visit Bill's website to learn more about the Leopold Project and the other work that he's doing that's been inspired by Leopold. Today I'm going to talk about Aldo Leopold's life to give you some context for a Sand County Almanac, where his ideas came from. I'm going to talk about the dominant themes in a Sand County Almanac and about the enduring effects of this work. Now, how many of you have read a Sand County Almanac? Oh, that's awesome. And those of you who haven't, I'm going to read little pieces from it, and I hope that this will stimulate your interest in picking up this book. It's a book that I think every single person should read. Aldo Leopold was born in Burlington, Iowa in 1887. He was the eldest of four children. Here he is at about the age of 8 or 9, and his father was an avid sportsman, and they had a country house in Michigan at the lake, and they would go there and fish and hunt. So hunting and fishing were things that he grew up with early on. That and a very full immersion in the natural world. He started keeping nature journals from a very young age. And in them, there's this sense of how the profound detail with which he observed nature and how much it touched him. So at the age of 11, he wrote, "I like to study birds. I like the wren best of all birds. We had 13 nests of wrens in our yard last summer. We hatched 120 young wrens. Here are a few of our birds." And then he goes and lists about 25 species of birds. And this was, he was totally self-taught. He went away, his family was affluent, so he went away to prep school like most young men from an affluent background like his. He went to the Lawrenceville Prep School in New Jersey, and he wrote letters home every day, which was something that was required of all the students back then, but he wrote to his mother. The other thing that he did every day was he would go on what he called wanders. So he would just go walking. He would finish all of his schoolwork. He was brilliant. He would go to his lectures, work on his homework, and then he would take off and go on these rambles that would sometimes be 8-mile walks just through the countryside. And his objective was just to soak up nature, to experience what there was there. So this is from a letter to his mother. "This peculiar vireo reminds one of a chat in his actions. In plumage, he might be mistaken for a yellow throat, except for the white throat and more greenish sides. His haunts were saplings in the lower branches of trees. His song was a peculiar sputtering on a rising scale and was given during his search for insects." Now, part of what was going on here was that he was already deeply familiar with the Midwestern flora and fauna. Here he was in a completely new environment with different birds, and he was hungry and passionate to get to know them. This is one of his letters, and in the Aldo Leopold papers, I found hundreds of letters to his mother, and they are all filled with this sort of thing. So what 16-year-old boy focuses on stuff like this, you know? But these are the things that mattered most to him. In Round River, which was a collection of unpublished essays that was posthumously published, he wrote, "I heard once of a boy who was brought up an atheist. He changed his mind when he saw that there were 100-odd species of warblers, each bedecked like to the rainbow, and each performing yearly sundry thousands of miles of migration about which scientists wrote wisely but did not understand. I dare say this boy's convictions would be harder to shake than those of many inductive theologians." So he had a profound love of the natural world. And not only that, he saw it as a holy thing, a sacred thing. And that underlay everything that he did as in his career as a wildlife manager, as a natural resources manager, which I'm going to talk about now. So in 1906, Gifford Pinchot founded the Yale School of Forestry with an endowment from his family and started a new era for natural resources management in America. his ideas were revolutionary and groundbreaking, and they had to do with a developing awareness of the finite nature of our natural resources, rather than America being a place where there was so much of everything and we could just take all we wanted. He was the first chief of the Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot. So these are the ideas that the Forest Service was founded on trying to figure out how we were going to deal with running out of natural resources and how to use what we have wisely. He, of course, set out to manage these forests to benefit cattle and deer and humans from a very anthropocentric perspective. And this also included exterminating predators. So in 1909, Leopold was part of the second graduating class with a master's degree from Yale. He was immediately posted in New Mexico and Arizona in District 3 in the Apache National Forest. Here he is. He went shopping before he went out west, and he got all what he thought was all the proper attire. He was so excited. I saw in his personal correspondence how he just couldn't wait. This was the adventure of a lifetime. And he went out and cruised timber with his men. Because of his master's degree, he was put in a mid-ranking supervisory role. And this is his he and his men heading out into the field. And in his notes, he writes about part of what they did, what he was tasked to do, is if he ran into a grizzly bear or a wolf, they were supposed to shoot it, and they did. So he referred to them as varmints. And this other image is from the U.S. Biological Survey predator extermination campaign, which ran through the 1910s, around the same era. So at that time, the conventional wisdom was the only good predator was a dead one. Predators were a nuisance, they created problems for humans, and we would have, the common knowledge was that we would have healthier deer and elk and more food for people if we shot all the predators. He was promoted to assistant forest supervisor in 1911. He married Estella Luna Berger in 1912. She was Hispanic. Her dad owned the largest sheep ranch in the Southwest. He was very wealthy. She, by the way, was a profound influence on him and was his muse in the very conventional sense of the word muse. He learned how to write. He was self-taught by writing love letters to her that were filled with poetry. And some of those lines in those love letters appear in a Sand County Almanac years later. So early career milestone, and this first one may not seem like a career milestone, but it was. He almost died in 1913. He was a newlywed. They were expecting their first child, and he developed acute nephritis, which his kidneys started to shut down on him. He was bedridden for a year and a half. He recuperated at his parents' home. During this time period, this was a life-changing experience. He was a somewhat arrogant older son from an affluent family who was used to everything going his way. And he spent time in bed reading all the philosophy he could get his hands on and reflecting deeply on our relationship with the earth, our human relationship with the earth, and how we use our resources. And he started keeping a pocket notebook about then that he kept in his breast pocket until the time he died. He had tiny little handwriting, and he noted in that pocket notebook some of the profound pieces of wisdom he got from people like Thoreau and Muir and from the Bible and philosophers like the Russian philosopher Uspensky. He recuperated and in 1919 rejoined the Forest Service and he rose higher within its ranks. So he was responsible for 20 million acres of national forest, and he was still fairly young. One of his biggest life achievements occurred in 1924. He created the first national wilderness, the Gila National Forest. And he did a lot of writing around that time about the value of wilderness. Most of his writings from the early to mid-20s were rejected. He, in fact, for a decade of his life, just about everything he wrote was rejected. He kept submitting things for publication to magazines and journals. His ideas were considered too extreme and radical. So he entered his mid-career. Toward the end of the 20s, he quit working for the First Forest Service, started writing a book on game management, which took many years to write. And to write it, he did detailed game surveys of all of the Midwestern states. His book was published in 1933, and it is a book that I cited in my dissertation today. It contains insights that are just as pertinent today as they were back then. He also, in that book, created the science of wildlife biology. Accordingly, he was appointed the first professor of wildlife. Note that it's spelled with two words. That's how it was spelled back then, at the University of Wisconsin in 1933. And his ecological education continued when he acquired a Wisconsin River farm called the Shack. This was totally trashed, worthless land. It had been over-farmed. The soil was depleted. There was massive erosion. There was very little growing on it. And he decided to buy this land and fix it and learn about ecology, learn about what it takes to create healthy land in the process. He assisted in founding the Wilderness Society. And that fall, he went on a fellowship to Germany to study forestry. And Germany was thought to have the most progressive forestry methods in the world at that point. And their forestry methods involved killing all the predators, removing all of the non-commercial species from the understory, and raising trees like crops. And they'd been doing this for 200 years at that point. These were old methods. And everybody lauded these methods. And when Leopold went and immersed himself in that, what he found instead was ecological wreckage. The trees were not doing well. They were diminishing in vigor. The deer and elk, there were huge numbers of them, and they were runty, stunted, genetically not doing well. And there was a deep lack of biodiversity. And so what he learned from that is this isn't the answer. It made sense, you know, let's grow trees like crops, but to do that as an overall on a landscape scale and apply that to all forests didn't work. So that's what he brought home with him from that. At the same time, he was working hard to restore his land, and this is what it looked like. So there he is with his wife Estella. They planted 20,000 trees. John Muir, who is also from this area, described it as this land. So this was the home place of John Muir, and just maybe 10 miles from the shack. And he described it as poor country for making money, but rich country for living. So Aldo Leopold fell passionately in love with this devastated landscape. And as those of you who have read a Sand County Almanac know that his experiences on this land informed the first section of Sand County Almanac. This is what the shack looked like in 2008. All those trees were trees that he planted, most of them. That's what the forest looked like. In fact, it became so overgrown they thinned it in 2008. So the shack lands, as his family called that area among themselves, inspired great work. It inspired certainly a Sand County Almanac. There's 15 years of phenological records. Does anybody know what phenology is? Yes? Phenology is the study of the cycles of things in nature, the time cycle. So what happens across the season to plants, to animals, bird migration, when flowers bloom, that sort of thing. And today, that land is the Leopold Memorial Reserve. They've acquired a couple thousand acres of additional land, and it is really an amazing place to visit. If you haven't been there, I strongly suggest that you go there. In 1936, he visited northern Mexico. He was an avid hunter, and I'm not going to be talking much about his hunting background in this talk, but hunting was very important to his family, and he was a subsistence hunter. They ate what they hunted. They didn't hunt for trophies. And so he and his brothers and his sons and daughters, his whole family hunted with him and his wife. They were always looking for new places to go that were relatively unspoiled. So he took one of his sons with him and he went with his brother Carl to northern Mexico in 1936. This is an area of Mexico that my family is from, and where my dad and my grandfather had a ranch during the 1930s. So what he found in Mexico, he wrote in his field journal that it was the first time he'd seen land that was intact. And what he found was a robust deer population, so lots of deer, a full suite, which means every species of large carnivores that there were in this ecosystem, very active predation, and flourishing vegetation. In other words, he saw this system that was functioning really well, where energy was cycling through that system very freely, and where every species was thriving. He contrasted this. This was back-to-back with his trip to Germany, and the lessons he learned by comparing those two were profound. His insights were on the value of wilderness areas, the importance of maintaining habitat, and the need for predators. In his final years, he focused on profound game management issues in his home state. He was the head of the game commission, and his daughter, Nina, told me that she thought that that was one of the causes of his death, the stress of that job. So there were too many deer, and they were all dying of malnutrition and disease. There were no predators, and he was advocating returning predators to this landscape, which nobody wanted to hear, and also killing does because there were too many deer reproducing, and there was no food for them, no natural food for them. None of that went over well with the public or with other managers. Between 1940 and 1948, he wrote a Sand County Almanac. Now, that's when he was officially working on the manuscript, but many of the pieces in a Sand County Almanac, I would say three-quarters of what's in there, is composed from writings that he did starting in about 1917. And he takes snippets, like most writers, I do this, I take snippets from this and that and reflections that I put down in different places. And so a Sand County Almanac is really the culmination of his life and reflections on the lessons that he's learned. He died in 1948 of a heart attack while fighting a wildfire on his neighbor's land next to the shack. So I'm going to talk about the anatomy of this classic. Written between 1940 and 1948, it was peer-reviewed by his student Albert Hochbaum. So he sent the entire manuscript to his student to ask him what he thought, and his student thought it was terrible. And Aldo Leopold, the student thought it was preachy. And so Aldo Leopold was a very humble man in the last half of his life. He wasn't so humble the first half of his life. And he did what every wise professor and advisor would do. He listened. And he did what his student suggested. And so the book that those of you who have read it have held in your hands is a result of that review from Aldo Leopold's student. And you know that that book has a very humble tone to it. That was the result of that review. So what his student said is, you act like you have all the answers, but you don't tell anybody what your mistakes were. You need to rewrite this to talk about what your mistakes were. He received notice. The book was rejected by a different publisher. He received notice, finally, from Oxford University Press 1 week before he died. So he got this wonderful news, went to the shack to do some spring. They were doing prescribed burns, actually. He was advocating prescribed burns. And then he died. The original title was Great Possessions. Oxford asked that title be changed. And his children got together in a panic and spent a couple of months working intensively to assemble the final draft of the manuscript because the publisher had asked for some revisions and some reorganization. For example, there were two forewords for it, to it. The one that he originally submitted, the publisher thought was too technical and also too personal. So it went into far greater depth than the short one that is in the current edition. And so he had an earlier draft of that, and so his family worked with that manuscript to get it into condition to be published. And Albert Hochbaum, his student, was also part of this group. So the themes, well, the main theme is wildness. And he wrote in the introduction, "There are some who can live without wild things and some who cannot. These essays are the delights and dilemmas of one who cannot." The book is in three parts. Each part has a different function, and one can look at the whole book as a philosophical argument that is presented by a master. So the first piece of it is, superficially, it's a list of sketches, of essays about time at the shack. And they're pretty folksy, they're pretty down to earth. And so you can look at it as the phonology of a year at the shack, what it's like. However, when you start reading them, you see pretty quickly that his objective is to touch people's hearts. To touch people's hearts with the beauty and the ethics and in some places the heartbreak of what we have done to landscapes without preaching. And he's very self-deprecating in it. It's very, very personal. It goes into great, he gives you astonishing insights into his feelings about the land in every essay. So none of it is dry. And it is very much about the place. So before we move on to part two, I'm going to read you some vignettes here. So he uses poetic language considerably through these essays as a way to engage people. Now, this is a scientist, and he uses poetry as his main objective here is to get people's attention. This is on a spring flood. "There are degrees and kinds of solitude. An island in a lake has one kind, but lakes have boats, and there is always the chance that one might land to pay you a visit. A peak in the clouds has another kind. But most peaks have trails, and trails have tourists. I know of no solitude so secure as one guarded by a spring flood. Nor do the geese, who have seen more kinds and degrees of aloneness than I have. So we sit on our hill beside a new-blown pasque, that's a flower, and watch the geese go by. I see our road dipping gently into the waters, and I conclude with inner glee but exterior detachment that the question of traffic in or out is for this day at least debatable only among carp." So there's humor and celebration here. His daughter Nina told me sometimes they would get stranded there for a week due to flood waters. And those were times actually for celebration. Here's one on hunting at the shack in October. Hunts differ in flavor, but the reasons are subtle. The sweetest hunts are stolen. To steal a hunt, either go far into the wilderness where no one has been, or else find some undiscovered place under everybody's nose. That would be the shack. Here's one on larch, also in the fall. So he is doing some work on his land, and he decides to take a lunch break. And during lunch, he starts reflecting. Lunch over, I regard a phalanx of young tamaracks, their golden lances thrusting skyward. Under each, the needles of yesterday fall to earth, building a blanket of smoky gold. At the tip of each, the bud of tomorrow performed, poised, awaits another spring. And here's a short passage on cottonwood, which was widely regarded a junk tree to be eliminated at that time. He was way ahead of his time, and he saw it as a very important species because it harbored biodiversity, great diversity of other species. To me, an ancient cottonwood is the greatest of trees because in his youth he shaded the buffalo and wore a halo of pigeons. And I like a young cottonwood because he may someday become ancient. So, part two involves lessons that he learned in Wisconsin and beyond, and these essays are sharper and address ecological issues. They're very place-based. Also, Marshland Elegy, it's about his reflections on migration, crane migration, and geese migration, and he wrote Marshland Elegy much earlier, maybe in the mid-30s. Thinking Like a Mountain, this was an essay that his student Albert Hochbaum shredded. And he said, "You talk like you're so holier than thou about these wolves. You should tell them how many wolves you've killed in your lifetime." And so he did. Song of the Gavilan, which was about his time in Mexico, what he saw there. And Clandeboy, which was about Manitoba. So, I'm going to read you a portion of Thinking Like a Mountain. How many of you have read this essay? It's very famous. So, when I started my research, I wanted to know whether this was something that actually happened or whether it was just an apocryphal story. And I asked his family, his daughter Nina and other people, Estella, and they didn't know. They thought about it. We talked about this for 2 years, and finally they realized that it was something that had actually happened. And he's cruising timber with his men in 1909, and he shoots a mother wolf and suffers pangs of remorse and doesn't understand why he feels that way. And it wasn't until later in life that he put it all together, why it had felt so wrong, which when at the time his job was to kill all these predators, and he thought that was the smartest thing to do. We reach the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realize then and have known ever since that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view. Since then, I have lived to see state after state extirpate its wolves. I have watched the face of many a newly wolfless mountain and seen the south-facing slopes wrinkle with a maze of new deer trails. I have seen every edible bush and seedling browsed, first to anemic desuetude and then to death. Such a mountain looks as if someone had given God a new pruning shears and forbidden him all other exercise. In the end, the starved bones of the hoped-for deer herd, dead of its own too much, bleached with the bones of the dead sage, or molder under the highline junipers. I now suspect that just as a deer herd lives in mortal fear of its wolves, so does a mountain live in mortal fear of its deer. So, part three is where he takes off the gloves. There's these are the four essays that form part three. They were all written in the 1920s. Some of them, like The Land Ethic, was written over a 17-year period. When you read the book, they're seamless, they're flawless, they flow. They're cobbled together from journal articles, unpublished field notes, and talks that he gave to audiences, such as the Garden Club during the Dust Bowl era in the Midwest. And I'm going to read you... Oh, wait. So he defines an essay in this third part, but first of all, essays are commonly... ethics are commonly defined as a set of principles of right conduct or a theory or system of moral values. He defined ethics as pertain to land as this: an ethic ecologically is a limitation on freedom of action in the struggle for existence. So it means that as much as humans have to strive to meet our needs for survival, such as food, wood, natural resources to improve our lives, an ethic involves limiting how much we take and doing that consciously. He wrote, and this is his expression of the land ethic, "A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise." He also wrote that people abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When one sees land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. So he reflected long and deep on this. The land ethic itself, you know, that statement I just read you and things like this evolved over a 17-year period. So here are some further thoughts on the land ethic. "A land ethic, of course, cannot prevent the alteration, management, and use of these resources, but it does affirm their right to continued existence and at least in spots their continued existence in a natural state. In short, a land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community to plain member and citizen of it. It implies respect for his fellow members and also respect for the community as such." They're strong words. So his concept of land health became a culminating vision for him of human prosperity and ecological harmony with humans as part of the land community. It became a yardstick for how people measured their relationship to the land, and it reflected his 1922 standards of conservation. So back in 1922, he prepared a report for the government listing the standards for wise use and conservation. The land ethic has been cited widely by the Forest Service and the BLM and conservation organizations in support of ecosystem management. Some applications are water quality, maintaining good habitat for wildlife and good populations of wildlife, livestock management, sustainable timber harvest, and of course scenery and aesthetics, which in this book he talks about the importance of aesthetics throughout the book. Maintaining healthy forests, which is a lot harder than one might think because there are no easy solutions. The northern spotted owl debate, it's a conundrum, really, what the best thing to do is. It has been applied to restore all of these species that you see here, to, I wouldn't say to optimal situations, but, you know, these are species that were almost extinct during the time of his life. Also, sandhill cranes, when he surveyed them, he found 15 breeding pairs in the 1930s, and today we have 750,000. And we did that very consciously by applying some of his principles. was a visionary way ahead of his time. In 1915, he wrote about humans as an integral part of nature rather than apart from nature. Now, some of these are going to astonish you. In 1917, he advocated allowing fire as a natural force and setting prescribed fires. In 1917, in a report to the Forest Service, he wrote that climate change was one of our biggest problems. He advocated sustainable use and living lightly on the land starting in the early 20s. In 1936, he started writing about allowing predation to be a natural force of nature like fire to create healthy ecosystems. He referred to a balance of nature. Today, we know that doesn't really exist. And in 1942, he suggested reintroducing wolves in Yellowstone. He visited the park. He was invited to visit the park and evaluate its land health, and that was in his report. Enduring value of Leopold's ideas, well, there's a lot, and this could be the source of multiple other talks. I'm only going to focus on one, which has to do with my work and the work of other scientists, which is the trophic cascades concept, and I'll explain what that is, and the keystone predator concept. So trophic cascades are a relationship among members of a food web in which a keystone predator, a top predator, influences the abundance of its prey, but also its behavior, and that in turn affects everything else. So when you remove a keystone, arches and ecosystems fall apart. That's the idea. So these concepts are based on Leopold's work. They were articulated starting in the 1960s, but they're based on the premises he set up. And few people have done more work on this topic than Ripple and Vesta, who are two Oregon State University scientists. And they've worked in Yellowstone and six other national parks looking at what these systems were like when there were no wolves and what they are now that wolves have returned. And what they're noting is that the vegetation is starting to grow lush again, that vegetation that was over-browsed before is coming back. And they have noted something called the ecology of fear at work here, which means that elk and deer, when there are wolves present, behave very differently. They have to be wary in order to stay alive, and that changes what they eat and how they eat. So rather than mowing down vegetation, as Aldo Leopold described in Thinking Like a Mountain, they have to keep moving and be very careful, so they take quick bites. And that changes the dynamics of the whole ecosystem. So this is from my own research. This is in Glacier National Park. This is an aspen stand in front of a wolf den, which is the first den that wolves naturally recolonized. They came down from Canada in the mid-1980s. The big trees date back to when there were wolves in that system, the early 1900s. The smaller trees, they're about this tall. They date back exactly to when wolves returned to the system. And in between, there were no trees that were able to grow above the hungry mouths of elk. It's pretty dramatic. This is called a recruitment gap. And what happens is that this creates habitat for species. This is an American redstart, which is a United Nations red-listed warbler. It's a warbler very much at risk. It's declining throughout its range. It needs that low canopy. That's where it nests and that's where it feeds. And so when you knock that out because of too much herbivory, the deer and elk eating everything, you lose those warblers. So they're returning to places where wolves have returned. I'm going to close by reading a passage from my book that illustrates some of this and where I talk about the shack. One November, I worked in Waterton Lakes National Park, Alberta, to measure ecology of fear effects. The wind blasted across the Alberta prairie, nearly knocking over my tripod and spotting scope. I steadied them with my gloved hands and tucked my chin deeper into the collar of my down parka. It felt more like mid-January in this extreme landscape where most years the only month I didn't experience snow at my field sites was July. I was out here using yet another method to determine whether elk fear wolves. Conservation biologist Joel Berger, who has done global research on the fear of predation, believes this phenomenon underscores more fundamental questions, the meaning of fear itself, and how it can affect ecosystems. My teenage daughter Bianca had joined me in the field. We were watching a herd of approximately 400 elk cows, which stood on a high bench land on the southeastern border of the park. Most had their heads up, scanning the landscape rather than eating. They skittishly grazed on tawny remnants of prairie grasses that poked up through the thin snow, taking quick bites, looking up for some long moments before stealing another mouthful of food. "What's up with the elk?" asked Bianca. "You'd think there are wolves nearby," I said. "You think?" she asked. Soon the wolves would oblige us with an answer. The ecology of fear has deep roots. Staying alive during the early Pleistocene epoch involved escaping large creatures with sharp teeth and claws. This meant that prey species evolved behavior driven by survival. Vigilance, time spent head up looking for threats, is essential for survival in systems with top predators, but it comes at the expense of time spent eating. For the past 2 years, I had been doing focal animal observations on elk. This involved watching one animal at a time, recording how long it spent with its head down feeding versus head up scanning for predators. I had categorized my study sites as areas of high, medium, and low wolf presence. I wanted to know whether fear varied on the basis of wolf density, and from that, to learn how many wolves would be enough to trigger changes in herbivory patterns, a trophic cascade. Would one pack passing through an area occasionally but not denning there have the same effect as two very large packs that had produced multiple litters of pups in 1 year? How about one pack that kept hanging on despite losing half of its members annually as a result of human-caused mortality in an area where it was legal to shoot wolves outside the park? The elk I observed on that blustery November afternoon in my medium wolf density area were far more skittish than usual. All at once, five black shapes crested the bench, fluidly trotting through the elk. Wolves. We'd seen their tracks earlier that day, pressed into a skiff of snow on the chief mountain highway. Few humans visited the park between the late fall and spring. Predators and other wildlife adapted to this by increasing their use of park roads that are closed to vehicle traffic in the off-season. Even though through the blowing snow, I could see that these wolves were muscular and well-fed. They moved comfortably through the herd, shifting into a slow lope, tails high. The elk parted as the wolves passed, and then they regrouped a short distance away, heads up, bunched more tightly for safety. The wolves didn't stop but continued on their way, disappearing over an escarpine ridge. It was a long while before the elk settled and resumed feeding, and their vigilance level remained high for hours. Their earlier restlessness made perfect sense. Aldo Leopold was among the first to observe the behavioral effects of lack of predation on his own land. In 1935, he bought an abandoned farm in southwestern Wisconsin to use as a hunting reserve. He subsequently dubbed the farm the Shack. This land, now known as the Leopold Memorial Reserve, lies 45 miles north of Madison on the southern edge of Wisconsin's Sand Counties. The Leopold family spent every weekend there restoring the land. Between 1939 and 1940, in his Shack journals, Leopold noted the effects of deer herbivory on herbaceous plants and the trees he had planted on his land, which included oaks and aspens. He commented that some species were being nipped down to 18 inches in height. In a game survey, he also documented how humans had by then eliminated wolves from much of Wisconsin. Deer had exploded in northern Wisconsin from several hundred in 1920 to at least 100,000, causing game managers to formally acknowledge the problem. Although things were not this bad at the Shack, Leopold noted ongoing plant damage caused by deer, which in the absence of wolves calmly stood their ground and browsed young saplings down to nothing. There is a saying that the more things change, the more they stay the same, and an older Romanian proverb from the Carpathian that states that where wolves go around, the forest grows. Both pieces of folk wisdom came to my mind when I visited the shack to see whether the current aspen growth pattern and deer behavior would fit Leopold's historical observations. It was mid-April as I drove along the rural road that runs through the Leopold Memorial Reserve, noting small herds of deer standing around with their heads down eating shrubs. I spent the next few days examining the amount of browsing on aspen. One day, Alda Leopold's daughter Nina, Leopold Bradley, joined me in the field. Her chocolate Labrador retriever Maggie ran glad circles around us as we examined the aspens around the shack for evidence of deer herbivory. Almost all the aspens were below the height a deer can reach to eat. They had chisel-pointed ends where deer had bitten off the apical stem, the dominant growth bud. Many had zigzagging trunks where they had been browsed and had healed and then had grown in a different direction. I held my measuring rod to an aspen less than 3 feet tall and counted its browse wounds, 8 in all, each marked by a crook in its trunk. I showed Nina how telltale signs on the aspen allowed us to distinguish from browsing from disease, because the latter made the tree's growth tips atrophy. All aspens can sustain moderate browsing, but these bonsai aspens look stunted and shrub-like. With chronic herbivory, they would eventually die. Indeed, we found many that had succumbed in this manner. Nina and I reflected on how little things had changed at the shack since her dad's era. As we continued to walk, she recalled his observations about the effect of wolf removal on deer behavior and how deeply this awareness affected him. My father always said it all had to do with relationships, but he couldn't convince managers of that. He was even unable to convince some of his best friends. He had found stacks of dead deer as big as a house in northern Wisconsin, and his colleagues would not vote for a doe hunting season. I think we have the same problem today. I do not think that people, even at the highest level, quite understand the interdependence of all these issues. We still have too many deer. We still have hunters thinking we don't have enough deer. And we still have no wolves here. So, this is a lot to think about, so I urge you, those of you who haven't read this book, to think about all of this. Let it inform you as you dip into this book. It doesn't have to be written in a linear way. You don't have to read it from start to finish. You could just dip into it. So please enjoy. I want to thank the Alda Leopold Foundation, Kurt Miney, who's the Leopold biographer, Bill Ripple and Bob Beshta, Nina Leopold Bradley, and that photograph is of me walking with her at in the shack woods, and we're talking about, that was the day we were looking at the aspen, actually. Hal Selwasser, who has greatly inspired my work. He was one of Starker Leopold, all the Leopold sons' last students. Mary Brown and Connie Georgiou. Thank you. I can take some questions, and I also have some copies of my book for anybody who's interested.
And for those of you with questions, if you would kindly use the microphone, we'll pass around to you after you're called on.
Yes?
This is kind of a footnote, but Corvallis has a connection to the Leopold family. It's not an accident that Starker Leopold was named as he was, a fellow who I was fortunate to study with at Berkeley. But T.J. Starker is, and I forgot the exact connection, but he's a relative of the Leopold family and all the other Starkers who are still around.
Yes, they own the Starker Forest, and I actually researched this for Nina Leopold. They're cousins. Yes?
What happened to Mr. Hochbaum?
Mr. Hochbaum became a professor on his own, and he did wildlife research inspired by all the Leopold. He got a PhD working with Leopold. I think his doctorate, he completed it maybe in 1943. Yes, over here? Yes.
If humans are meant to be a part of nature, was there a time in our history when we were in balance with nature here in the United States?
Well, that's a very controversial topic. There have been whole books written on that. I think that humans have always used the natural world and sometimes used it too heavily. Even people who were here 10,000 years ago. But we have been learning from our mistakes. And what's going on now, though, is we have technology that is greatly accelerating our ability to use resources. And we've made some big mistakes, and we're learning from them, too. Yes?
Did any of his four children become conservationists and in the picture, when did any of his four children become conservationists? And in the family photo, when his daughters are sitting on the ground, which one was Nina?
They all became scientists and conservationists, and they had brilliant careers. So they couldn't get enough time at the shack. They were so excited about being there. And if you can picture four teenagers who could go do anything, and the shack is way out in the middle of nowhere, and rather than hanging out in Wisconsin and Madison with their friends, they would go to the shack. I'll show you the picture. Let me see. And so his daughter, Estella, she is emeritus faculty at the University of Wisconsin. Let's see if I could find this picture. One of his sons was a hydrologist. This is Nina right here, and that's Estella. So, they were all... they were all distinguished professors. Nina was not a professor. She studied wildlife in Africa with her husband, and then she came back and she made her life's work restoring the shack and creating all the Leopold Foundation and helping preserve her dad's papers. Yes?
Did Alda Leopold write anything about human beings, population being a problem, human beings being a problem? He talked about the deer, you quoted that, and big piles of dead deer because there was no predator or keystone predator. Did he write on population being a problem?
Yes, see, there's a lot of writing he did on wilderness, and he talked about how we want to go everywhere, and there's so many of us everywhere, and that we can't do that. We're going to, do major damage, ecological damage, if we do that. He lived in an era when there were a lot fewer humans than there are today, but he was aware that we already had a population problem, very much so. Yes, in the back.
What did he attribute climate change to?
He didn't know. He did connect climate change. So there were a series of droughts in the United States starting around 1910, and he noted climate change after the second drought, which was, I think, in around 1917. And he was assigned to go around the southwestern U.S. and measure erosion and habitat for the Forest Service. So he visited every national forest and took lots and lots of notes. And he wrote letters to his mother and to his wife talking about climate change and erosion. So he thought that things that we had done. The other thing I didn't put in here is he complained about overstocking the range with cattle and what a terrible ecological problem that was creating. So he felt that combined with the drought we're creating this downward spiral and causing all the plant communities to migrate, you know, up higher than they normally would be, and then fire suppression added to that. So that's the first mention I've seen anywhere of climate change being an issue. Yes?
This may be an impression of mine, and for some of the naysayers of Leopold that I've run into, it seems like Leopold's life and his legacy and the writings of St. County Almanac have always been kind of behind the scenes and favored amongst a select group of conservationists and environmentalists, but it seems like John Muir's writings and others kind of were elevated, and the criticisms I've run across were that Leopold, his land ethic wasn't truly environmental or environmentalism or preservationist, that there wasn't enough of that in there. Did you ever find that certain people don't favor Leopold's philosophy? Because it strikes me as somebody who's a wildlife biologist that this, he has it right on. There's a nice balance. But that Muir and other preservationists have kind of gotten credit or quoted more often.
Well, they were philosophically very different. I cite him as an inspiration. He was a very early inspiration, but then their paths went like this. So Muir wrote about keeping humans out of nature, out of certain places. And he wrote about humans here and nature over here, and nature with a capital N, right? And there was a religious component to this. Aldo Leopold, from the start, wrote about humans being an integral part of nature, and that we can't remove ourselves from nature, because when we do, we create a stronger split. And so in the conservation community, there are today, and Michael Soule, who some of you may know who he is, he's the founder of conservation biology. He's one of my mentors and a close friend. And he was among the people who in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s said, we have to keep humans out of nature and put fences and create preserves and leave things alone. Today, he says, I was so wrong. Aldo Leopold was right, that the only way we're going to figure things out is if we realize we are part of this web of life, and we have to work with that web to find a way to heal it. So that's the philosophical split between Muir and Leopold. Leopold has been criticized as somebody who is came from a resource extraction background. But the reality is we need resources. He always advocated having a light footprint on the land, and that's part of what the shack was about, was an experiment in that. And there are those who could argue that Aldo Leopold was wealthy, so he could afford to have a grand experiment like that. But I think that there are many lessons for us today as we struggle with these questions that really don't have any clear answers, like climate change.
I think we have time for one more question.
Yes.
And that would be Craig.
Yeah.
I've always been troubled by the ugliness of the interaction between the predator and the victim at the time that the predator overwhelms the victim. And I wonder whether Leopold was ever troubled by this or ever considered this in any of his writings.
No, he did not write about it. I think that as a scientist, that's what I study as a scientist, and I know that's some of what he studied, that we come to this awareness that predation has always been a part of nature, and that when we try to stop it, we inadvertently create far greater suffering, such as those stacks of starved deer that he was finding in Wisconsin. So predation isn't pretty, and you should see some of my other presentations, like my thesis defense presentation. We'll have lots of images of predation. But there is a beauty to it for those who understand some of these ecological principles. So thank you very much. It's been wonderful talking to you.